Siren Radio. Siren 107.3. Visit us at sirenonline.co.uk.
Hopefully that makes sense. Weather today, highs of 20 degrees centigrade, lows of 9 degrees centigrade. And after some morning showers, it's going to be a light cloudy day with some light breezes.
South on Lakeshore Drive, getting into town, just slipping on my own LSD, Friday night trouble bound. It's Friday night and you're looking clean, too early to start the rounds. A 10-minute drive from the Gold Coast back makes you show your pleasure bound. It's 4 o'clock in the morning and all the people have gone away. Just you and your mind at Lakeshore Drive, and tomorrow is another day. And the sun shines fine in the morning time, tomorrow is another day. And there ain't no road just like it. Running south on Lakeshore Drive, getting into town, and just snaking on my own LSD, finding that trouble bound.
Radio 107.3. The joys of love being in the air, quite literally, if you're actually taking the trips abroad and various other bits and pieces. New research has suggested that 4 passengers on a typical flight have met the love of their lives, and with 11.9 million people flying each day, that's pretty much the population of Cuba, the chances of finding in-flight love are higher than many may imagine. Now, to discuss this and more aspects with respect to the whole notion of that immortal l'amour, who better than relationship expert and general all-round awesome person, Lady Nadja Essex. How are you, Nadja?
Hello, I'm very well. How are you?
Excellent. Delighted to touch base with your good self, particularly as you do the Celebs Go Dating package. So literally, you've got your finger on the pulse of this whole system. Any surprises in this particular survey? I mean, I would have thought sometimes people, if you're scared of flying, you could have all sorts of challenges in terms of your relationships.
Well, it's fascinating because you never think about what happens sort of in general when you go on a plane. And, you know, HSBC has commissioned this huge study about the country in the sky. And it's called Flyland. And so many fascinating things happen when you're in Flyland. So like you said, four passengers on a typical flight have met the loves of their life, which I just find phenomenal. I think that's wonderful statistics. And I will, every flight from now on, being like, is it you? Is it you? And I personally have met somebody on a flight that I got on as a single girl and I came off nearly with a boyfriend.
Good grief. I mean, of course, there is that notion that you're a captive audience to a certain extent, which could be for good or for ill in many ways.
Absolutely. And it's I mean, we came back from Vegas, so we had, well, was it about an 11-hour flight. So we had about four dates in that time. You know, you have a drink, you have, you know, you watch a movie together, you sort of go to sleep, you wake up, you have food. So it's like dating on the ground, but, you know, very, very, you're next to each other, you're sat down and in very close proximity.
Back in the 20th century, of course, the likes of Jackie Collins and others made great play of the Mile High Club. We won't go there for obvious reasons, but in terms of the whole notion of the romantic relationship that comes through, and as we said, this flyland scenario, it does seem as though actually you've got this notion of in-air dating. Can you see this becoming a kind of almost a marketing thing for airlines to actually run romantic trips and indeed dating agencies to set up a conceivable celebrity go dating in the air?
You've said it. I'm trademarking it as we speak. I'm on the phone to the solicitor. It's fabulous. And actually, with statistics like what we've seen, you know, meeting someone in the air is a genuine possibility. You know, you could meet your future husband or wife on the next flight you go on. How exciting is that?
Indeed, or indeed frightening, depending on your particular perspective on that system. Interesting that a sandwich is the meal choice for a third of flyers, that actually it's that sandwich which is there. And it's certainly fair to say that airline food, not necessarily the best and the highest of cuisine.
No, I think a sandwich you're kind of safe with. You know, we all see the sort of hot food options and they all look a little bit sort of ropey. So I love a good sandwich. You can't really go wrong with a nice BLT. And also the drink of choice being a gin and tonic, with 3 million being served every day.
Indeed, or indeed vegetarian equivalent, or vegan equivalent, if you're stepping to that side, etc. I can see how business connections can be made on flights. Any particular notion as to whether this is going to be, whether you turn right or turn left on a plane? Is it a case of business standard or whatever rating we're looking for? Because certainly some of the airlines that exist out there, actually just surviving is probably a success as opposed to setting up a relationship.
Absolutely. And it is difficult because, you know, one would think that if you sort of get on and turn left that you're going to create better contacts because you're in sort of, you know, business or upper. But actually, I've found that that can be, you know, when you're in sort of upper class or first class, because you have your little pod, you don't actually connect as much with people. So sitting sort of coach is actually a much better way to be able to chat with the people around you because they're there and you can't sort of shutter yourself in. And I've personally, again, met friends and business colleagues on flights that I'm still in contact with now. But I'm a chatter. So, I love to get on a plane. I take my shoes off. I get comfortable, get myself a little G&T. And then I'm like, hello, Mr. Neighbour next door. So tell me about you. What do you do? And then we have a chat.
And is that the best way to actually start off a conversation? I mean, what are your own top tips, Nadia, in terms of people who are travelling who, in the back of their mind, they're thinking maybe we should actually sort of look at a potential partner here?
Well, my biggest top tip that I always say is ask for a favour. So, you know, they bring you over the drink and they give you a little napkin, hide your napkin, and then ask, you know, the potential hottie next to you if they have a spare napkin. And what that does is it opens a dialogue, but without being too sort of in your face, cheesy chat up line. And then, you know, that way, if there could be chemistry, then they're likely to be like, no, I don't have a napkin, but let me go and get you one. And then that starts a conversation. Or if they're not interested, it's very much a case of no, and then they put their headphones back in. So either way, you know.
And presumably long haul as opposed to short haul would be preferable in many ways?
Well, a short haul, I met a little young man on a short haul flight recently, and he's just starting his Instagram, and I was very happy to help promote it. And, you know, you can get a lot done in a short haul flight. If there's enough time to serve you a G&T and a sandwich, there's enough time to make connections.
So clearly, Nadia, you've got your finger on the pulse when it comes to this. HSBC.co.uk, is that the best place to go to for further information?
Absolutely.
Lady Nadia Essex, two final questions for you, actually. We need to ask them because it's essential. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
Yes.
Good. This is all right. It's a kind of customer satisfaction thing. So can we look forward to connecting with you again in the not-too-distant future? Will you be kind enough to return?
I would hope so. Yes, please.
Still not sure whether she's actually a real title lady. Lady Nadia Essex. Somebody would actually know when he was actually editor of International Who's Who would obviously be Richard Fitzwilliams. Richard Fitzwilliams. Lady Nadia Essex and etiquette for meeting people on flights and so on?
I wish her well.
Well, exactly. This is the best way forward. I take it you didn't fly over to Burgundy, or did you?
No, in fact, there is a little station, Calais, which is an absolutely perfect place for a pickup, and you can literally arrive there. It can only fit in, the waiting room, about 2-3 dozen people, and it's absolutely ideal. Now, I went, actually, with friends, very kindly gave me a lift in their luxurious Bentley, which had a superb sound, because I was quite operatic, because we were playing classical music of various sorts, and that was delightful. Then coming back, quite literally an hour from Calais to St Pancras, I wonder how many people know of this particular
thing. It'll all change after the Brexit thing occurs. It'll go to months and years before you actually allow it.
Alex, may I correct you? If and when, we just don't know what's going to happen, but one of the things I do think people are going to have a really, really rude awakening, and that is if it goes ahead, and depending on what is or is not agreed, we have no idea at all at the moment, people talking about no deal and then possibilities of deals and so forth, one of the things that really will hit them when they are in passport queues, and also, don't forget the way the value of the pound's dropped, that people are taking that for granted at the moment, but on the holidays, that will affect us. Hopefully some agreement can be fixed. But again, when it comes to Brexit, where there is no majority in Parliament, the possibility of a second referendum, a possibility also be balanced of a lot of those who voted Remain saying get it over with because that's the way people voted, and any possibility could just occur. We simply don't know, and this political uncertainty is, I think, very damaging.
Sharks, Richard. Lots of sharks in politicians. Huge mega sharks. Sharks that come up from beyond the sea. Sharks that actually invade other sharks.
Well, one of the things about the meg is you know where you are. Let it be said that a movie like this, you have your fan base. You know what it's about. It says what it's about on the poster. Therefore,
it's got a big shark with Jason Statham.
Right. That is a statement I cannot disagree with. As a result, people who like sharks will go to see it, and when they go and see it, they'll see
Jason Statham.
Statham, he has a habit in this movie of mumbling as though he was a bit ashamed of the dialogue now.
But he's obviously got, you know, time where he's having to chill out with his ex-wife who manages to locate him directly and instantly find exactly the bar in the country that they can go straight to locate him. And I was also very impressed with the fact that, as was pointed out by Robin Pierce on the Stone Tapes, the amount of stubble on Jason Statham remains the same consistently throughout the entire movie, which is great.
It does. Indeed, there is no change in his looks, and I have to say, I could sort of broadly make out what he was mumbling. Frankly, I can't say I cared a great deal, but I will say this of this movie. A movie that delivers, that it promises, all right, it's directed by John Turteltaub, and it's not for the sophisticates. But if you want sharks and you want rather a lot of water, and you want lots of spills and thrills and escapes of one sort or another, or not. I was having quite a lot of fun, actually, in this movie, because I want to just set the tone, to be fair, mentioning what could be called a story. My goodness, this movie is full of cliches. It's absolutely bucket loads of
cliches. It's not so much a hunt as a massacre, as Jason might have said.
Oh, no spoilers, but let's say it's quite fun predicting who's going to die next. And also, they do use every cliche in the book. You could have a pretty good idea when the shark's going to attack, but not necessarily the way it will appear. And some of that visually is rather good. I mean, Jonas Taylor, played by, as you say, Jason Statham, is a rescue diver. He tried to save a group of scientists, but he couldn't save the last two because he's threatened by a giant creature. But the doctor, and the doctor, hello, my goodness gracious me, what's going to happen to him one day? Well, he dismisses him as having pressure-induced psychosis, not something I've ever heard of, but who knows, you bet he goes and becomes a bit of an alcoholic wreck. But he's called upon when something really big happens 5 years later, because Dr. Jack Morris, played by Rainer Wilson, he's a bad man. You see, what happens to him? Oh, I won't say. He meets Dr. Minwei Zhang, played by Winston Chow, at the vast underwater facility called Mana One, where Zhang works with his daughter, Su Yin. She's pretty intrepid, my goodness me, played by Li Bing Bing. She's got her eye at once a time or other in the movie on you-know-who. And they plan to explore an even deeper section of the Marianas, where, yes,
don't go down there. You don't know what's going to come up and bite you.
How right you are. Taylor's ex-wife, Laurie, is indeed leading this mission. And they're attacked by a creature. The creature is the Megalodon, a prehistoric creature come back to life. Now, I mean, it's very easy to make fun of this movie because quite honestly, they're only real point is, I mean, they've seen Jaws so many times, they've swiped all sorts of bits from it, they have stretched it out to nearly 2 hours, and it is too long. But, I mean, I'm not being serious.
It's a big Megadon. You've got to have a big movie for a big Megadon. It's not like Jaws. It's not like a bigger boat. You're going to need a bigger movie.
Well, first, you need music that's better than you get here. Secondly, you get certain scenes where bathers are threatened because the action can move dangerously close to a tourist resort in China and or a beach in China. And then, put it this way, there's an upbunnin games going on here with photography that I have to say is pretty impressive. There's almost too much action. Jaws had a certain amount of action. But to create the tension that we had in that movie, and I'm not comparing the two because, I mean, there is no comparison. You didn't have action every 10 minutes. There's a certain amount of talking in this film. The amount of characterization is almost zero. Jason Statham could have walked through this movie had he been asleep. Not wise or too wise near the bottom of the ocean, but since you know perfectly well the shark's going to attack any minute, and indeed, if a shark is killed, what happens next and what happens after that? But it kind of delivers in the summer. I mean, it'll put enough bums on seats to justify at least some of the expanse of water and all the ups and downs and so forth. The humans have an odd habit of escaping when the Meg attacks by one, as it were, gigantic leap on board, whatever they're clinging to, I have to say, which I thought was very, very funny. Because you can get that, you can do that once, as in the original Jaws, but not twice and get anyone taking this movie seriously. But they'll go to be entertained, and it, on that level, don't let's be too cynical. The main object is to amuse, and it's made quite a lot of money.
Would you like a fun fact about the director of Megalodon, James Thomas? Of course, he's not Steven Spielberg yet, but who knows, bearing in mind the difference between Megalodon and Jaws. Fun fact, Richard, is that
John Turteltaub, I thought.
No. The joys of James Thomas was that he started his filmic career actually working with the President of the United States, because he was production assistant for 14 episodes of The Apprentice back in America back in 2007. So there we are. He's been used to dealing with sharks.
I have The Meg here, directed by John Turteltaub.
Sorry, I
can't connect with you here.
Well, we actually have... you're quite right. I was looking at Megalodon, which is completely different. There we
are. The whole point of this movie is it really doesn't matter. People who go to it or lie... There's quite a lot of tension. I mustn't mock too much. I mean, there is quite a lot of real...
It's fair to say, Richard, that David J. Howe actually thought the whole movie was a tribute to Meg Ryan. So let's just work away from that whole process.
If Meg Ryan was there, I think it might have improved it had she been given a script. But the trouble is, when there's no script, there's not much actors can really do. It's not that they're good or that they're bad, but my goodness, there is a bad man, and he could meet, I won't say what happens to him. I mean, it's an expanse of water throughout almost the entire movie, and something's going on, and kids will, I think, thoroughly enjoy it. I mean, you know, we must encourage people to go and see it on a wide screen, because on a small screen,
of
you
course.
Really will lose.
And John Turteltaub has indeed directed National Treasure, Book of Secrets. He's directed the first National Treasure. He's directed the TV miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, and of course did Rush Hour. So what more could you ask for?
Well, it's not the history of what someone's done that interests me so much as what they actually produce in the movie I'm seeing, and I have to say that I think it's really the underwater cameraman who should get the credit.
I mean, fair point. So let's move on to Black Klansman.
Well, we should have started with that, but we're waiting for the end for the impact. Now, this is a movie that, yes, there are flaws in this movie, but I was so bowled over by it that I have to say I'd give it 5 stars simply because of its audacity. I mean, Spike Lee is a talented and provocative, and this proves it. Obviously, the purpose of the movie is to highlight racial injustice, and it's an audacious, it's a skillfully constructed polemic by a virtuoso director who excels in highly unconventional uses of imagery. At the beginning, I thought, here we go again, this isn't going to work. He was effective enough to use clips from Gone with the Wind and Birth of a Nation, but Alex Baldwin portrays a fictional raving fascist, and not very convincingly. However, if you can link that climactically with footage of the clash between the protesters and white supremacist marchers at Charlottesville and Donald Trump's callous reaction to the murder of the white activist Heather Heyer, most emphatically you get an impact. And the story of this movie is what is so fascinating. I mean, it really is extraordinary. Firstly, it works on the level of the polemic that Lee wants. Secondly, it works, or a lot of it works, as a thriller, and also it works as a form of a black comedy. Almost unbelievably, its plot is based on the memoir of Ron Stallworth, played by John David Washington, who was the first African-American to join the Colorado Springs Police Force in 1972. And he's only a rookie, and his audacious plan is to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan by contacting it by telephone. Then a veteran white cop, Flip Zimmerman, played by Adam Driver, he's Jewish, and that's pretty dangerous, as the Klan's rabidly anti-Semitic, masquerades as Stallworth in the meetings with Klan members. And whilst the Klan is trying to broaden its appeal, several extremists are planning an arson attack, so it becomes a pretty dangerous mission. You have the tension, and you've got the side-splittingly funny conversations, where we have often used the use of split screens, so we get the maximum mirth from these conversations between Stallworth, who of course is black, and the members of the Klan, including its leader, the Grand Wizard David Duke, a very good performance by a lookalike, Topher Grace, who is convinced he's a white racist. Hilariously, he's a bit of a rookie, gives them his real name. That leads to trouble. And then Stallworth is instructed to act as Duke's police bodyguard when Duke visits Colorado, when he initiates Zimmerman into the Klan, and Zimmerman, of course, is Stallworth. Here you get scenes of impact. Lee, for example, intercuts the rituals of the Klan, which are so bizarre, with the story told by activist Jerome Turner, played by Halle Belafonte, to students of the hideously grisly lynching of a black man by a white mob in the early 1900s. And here, this is truly chilling. What Lee does is use a variety of devices. They don't all work, but most of them do. And it has the impact required. It's also got an excellent cast. A stalwart, John David Washington's got the presence, and he conveys the commitment. This guy really had imagination. Black man joining the Klan, an African-American member. It's unbelievable. Adam Driver, excellent as Zimmerman. Topher Grace is superb. I see some nominations coming up for the movie, as well as the cast. All the supporting roles superbly cast, including a few psychos. And I sit in the tube sometimes. I look around me and try and cast people in
movies.
Oh,
Richard, please, that's people watching. You need to sort of focus on your own portable device.
And here, film for our times, wonderfully cinematic, stressing the contemporary relevance of events. That is part of its main, that's its main function, really. It's a literal knowing some of the dialogue from time to time, and I won't say I bought the entire plot, especially at a function for Duke, where we have obviously condensed some action regarding the arson. But it is an unconventional movie, to put it mildly. It's a visceral film. It's got an unbelievable story. I felt quite numbed after it.
Well, Richard, I'm delighted to note that Megadon, a summer blockbuster movie, actually not Megadon, just the Meg. Forget Megadon. It's the Meg. I mean, I don't know why I was confused about that. It's about a Megadon, but the movie's called The Meg. Otherwise, you're going to see The Megadon, different director entirely. So good news from that. Black Klansman, obviously another Spike Lee oeuvre. And it's good to see we've progressed without mentioning the, quote, atrociously uninformative museum of the Battle of Agincourt in Burgundy, which is nice.
Well, you know,
we weren't going to mention the atrociously uninformative museum.
You know, it's closing, and the reason it's closing is
it's atrociously uninformative.
It most emphatically is extraordinary. They've got a museum there, obviously, to lure tourists in, because you can't overlook the site and what happened, because it really was just slaughter.
Once more into the breach, dear. No, that was Shakespeare.
Of course, and what you also need in the museum is a couple of the battle clips from those two films. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that they had Livia's was a ballet, not a battle. You didn't see any blood in it.
It was World War II, Richard. We had to motivate the troops.
Absolutely, and it was perfect for that point of view. And also, he had no money, so this was the one scene that he shot in Ireland outside. The rest of it was on the stage of the Globe or against stylized medieval backgrounds. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely brilliant. Cabrera's 1989 film, I thought, was superb for its period, with a king driven more by
pure Shakespearean propaganda, though, of course. I mean, if it wasn't
you
the longbows.
This is a very interesting point, because I have to say that you cannot play Henry V as other than an imperialist and a hero, which, I mean, Jude Law did it quite well on stage. I saw Mark Rylance at it. It is one of those roles which Alan Howard, I remember, was excellent as Henry V. It's a challenging role to bring off in times where we view imperialism, rightly, I think, with horror. But nonetheless, there's no question, if you actually look at what really happened, and the fact that so many of the French nobility were killed, the reason was that they were so anxious to get the English. They quite literally, in a muddy battlefield where the English had the French battle plan, led a charge with horses against arrows in armour where you couldn't really move or function. It's quite interesting, the one bit that the museum will no doubt keep in its next incarnation, which I hope will be a drastic change from...
Will that be less uninformative, then?
Well, I mean, it was absolutely bizarre, with slides projected everywhere we were watching. I mean, it's complete nonsense. I can only compare it to a visit I paid to Ely. We went to, a friend and I, to the house once occupied by Oliver Cromwell. That was a joke. But I mean,
he didn't like his humour, did Oliver, though, of course. He liked warts and all. That's why he stopped Christmas.
Well, that's a very interesting comment about the paintings, and you've tried to divert the conversation brilliantly. I've seen paintings of Cromwell, who said he wanted to be painted warts and all that. Wasn't in all the paintings.
No,
not all the portraits of
it. Richard.
I think if you act just for a second, if I may, you just put your head in one of the, because you're able to do this in the museum, the helmets. You can then see what the French nobility, as they advanced on foot after the cavalry charge, which was such a disaster, and you could see almost nothing weighed down in that arbor. I mean, it was a sort of killing field. It really was an absolute catastrophe for them. And no one's sure, even today, of the numbers involved. It was so disastrous.
Well, Richard, I'm off now to actually try and raise some funds to help Princess Regiani's wedding put together. So I think she needs every penny she can get.
May I wish you well.
Of course.
The wedding will not be televised.
Much loved.
Everyone would be interested, I think, in watching it. But I do think that, I would have gone for a smaller ceremony. For example, Zara Phillips' reception on board Britannia.
When your mum's the Sarah Ferguson, and your dad's the Prince Andrew, then surely you've got to roll out the barrel, surely.
Well, I would point out that Zara and Mike Tindall, they were stars in their own right. Her mother was the Princess Royal.
And it's the Princess Eugenie.
Yes, and also someone who doesn't carry out royal engagements and is ninth in line to the throne. I think that
happen. It's an outside bet, but it could happen. You never know.
Most unlikely it won't. And the other thing, yes, I think in a royal year, why not lay out a few red carpets? Because
exactly.
Does.
If it's good enough for Meghan, it should be good enough in a world of the Meg for, clearly, Princess Eugenie. See, obviously,
no, I think that is a comparison far too far.
You had the world watching
Harry and Meghan.
They probably thought they were going to see a movie directed by John Turtledove and got this wedding instead.
That may be. I mean, the thing with Princess Eugenie's wedding is that the press will have something to write about, and there'll be quite a lot written about them. But the problem is, and this really was a difficulty, I won't give my views on Sarah Ferguson on this program. But I would say this. I think that if you make your children HRHs, and they don't have royal roles, they have the worst of both worlds, because on the one hand, you've got journalists being fascinated by every holiday they take, and you've got press interest, and on the other hand, you've got the accusation you haven't much to do, because why should they? I mean, they aren't and won't under future King Charles, apparently, won't have royal roles. And also their father, fair enough, I mean, I think he was someone very much at ease in the Navy. And I think probably he did a great deal of good as Britain's special representative internationally for trade.
And he led the way with divorces into our current House of Windsor scenario.
And can you imagine staying at Balmoral and coming downstairs if you were Sarah Ferguson when she was a member of the royal family and looking at those papers with her and her friend in.
Let's not talk about toes. Let's keep the feet away from it, okay? Let's have a foot-free zone. That's the important thing.
As in the Sun, a headline from my memory, she had TOE go.
Well, there you are. Have you had a recently interesting telephonic link with us on the programme this morning, Richard
Fitzwilliams? Oh, I've enjoyed it immensely. Yes.
Are you back with us again next week?
Oh, I most certainly. Much to discuss.
Excellent.
In the universe, all alone. In the universe, that's how it feels. Now you in the universe. All alone in the universe. It gets so sad.
As we head towards the third decade of the 20th century, indeed 21st century, fast cars, finance and Facebook. Yes, new research has revealed that 22% of millennials are influenced by Facebook and 16% by Instagram in the car that they actually choose, which is three times as many millennials posting photos of the cars on social media. It's all out there in a virtual sense, and who better to start talking about some of the findings of this annual survey than a doctor of neuroscience, comedy writer, stand-up comedian. He's one of Cardiff University's finest. He is Dr. Dean Burnett. How are you, Dean?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Excellent. Well, it's always excellent to connect with our friends in the Principality. So this particular research, did it surprise you at all? Did you think, well, I kind of could have predicted that, really?
Yes, it did surprise me. I mean, I would have expected it, but it was a lot more stark than I thought. Like that, the influence of social media, like in the modern age, is well known, but I didn't realize it would have such power over buying decisions of such magnitude. So yeah, it was quite a surprise.
I mean, looking at the figures, drilling down into the numbers, 53% of millennials, which we're considering for this particular survey, is those being born between the early 80s and the late 90s, said that they bought a car because they actually felt that it would give them prestige or status. Depends on the car, surely.
Yes, of course, that's going to be a big part of it. But in some cases, just having a car in the first place
exactly
is a sign of prestige. Whereas, you know, having a fast car and a slick car is quite a well-known phenomenon. But for it to be, you know, now you can share it with the world. You can sort of say, "Look at my car! Look how cool my car is!" And then that becomes a big part of your life, because, you know, in the modern age, that's a big part of what we do and what motivates our behaviour.
And yet, of course, in a few years from now, we might have the end of the traditional automobile. It might all be driverless cars. Will the same impact be there when you actually say, look at this driverless car, then?
Imagine it would, yes. It's sort of like, you know, look how driverless my car is. Like, there's no wheel here at all, and you can, you know, it could head that way. But no, it's the fact that it's not much about, you know, which car it is. It's the fact that people are willing to spend so much on your car. Like, some parts of the service suggest that there are those who will spend more than half their monthly salary on a car that they technically don't really need because of the influence and prestige they feel it gives them, which is, you know, quite eye-opening.
Well, that, of course, is a really interesting and significant point, because I know that the traditional thing is that your car is traditionally the second biggest purchase after a house. But if you are actually going to go for a car, clearly if you're going for, shall we say, a baby Bentley or a top-of-the-range thing from that perspective, if you don't have the average salary of a Cardiff City footballer, sorry, I know they're not doing that well, but will they actually be able to call, are they getting into trouble as a result of that? Should they just actually dial back a bit and actually look to work within their means?
That's logically what you should say, yes. I mean, this research was done by Admiral Car Finance because they were worried about people being unable to pay for these high-profile cars and the things they want. And I guess it just shows a reflection of the current financial situation of millennials. Most of them can't afford a house. Like, house prices have gone through the roof and modern wages haven't really kept up. So they say it's the most, you know, the second biggest purchase. For some, it'll be the first, perhaps, because they don't have any prospect of owning a house or like having a high-profile career. So this is something else they can fall back on to feel good about themselves, and that's a reflection of wider society as a whole.
And do we have a situation where, in essence, the car could become the de facto house, that actually it's the easiest thing to do, buy a caravan and there you've sorted it?
Well, there are lots of moves towards, you know, like miniaturised housing now, and people like living on reconverted vans. You're seeing this happen more and more. So as houses become less and less affordable, then alternatives will spring up, and quite possibly, yes, there could be the fact that certain cars will be a de facto home. But I'm guessing that's not the reason like those in this research are buying them. It is because you can say, I have a car, look at my nice car, and share it with the wider world, because we have the option of doing that now.
In terms of the notion of sharing that scenario through social media and so on, again, the other aspect is the downside of social media, how it can actually suggest that, oh, look, my life is fantastic, and yet actually it's anything but, and that additional pressure for people who maybe don't have that sort of success, and they've made their sort of purchase, and it might be, you know, a good, decent banger, but they don't necessarily want to go through that side of things. Is this something else which simply adds to the pressure that we're all faced with in the 21st century?
Oh, definitely, yes. Like, you see things like online about, you know, Instagram influencers, people who portray that they have this amazing, incredible, high-profile, slick and cool life. And that's not reality. You know, it's very polished, it's very refined, because social media does give you the option of presenting yourself to the world as you want to be seen, not as you actually are. And that, but then people see that and think that's how the real world works. And it's always been the way. Like, you see people in papers and magazines, like, they're always airbrushed and stylized, and that's always been something that's happened. But now it's far more common, far more invasive. It follows you around in your pocket because you've got the mobile phone with you. And that's something which seems to be driving more decisions and more, you know, people to make things and do things that otherwise they wouldn't have done. And that's, you know, that's something to be keeping an eye on at the very least.
Are savvy manufacturers effectively looking to get more and more internet web savvy material connected with vehicles, so that actually you have that almost virtuous circle whereby you don't actually have to have your discrete devices? It's all built into the car itself with its Wi-Fi and everything else.
Well, I imagine that's very much happening. Yes, you see many cars now with, they're all hooked up to the internet constantly, and they have the inbuilt sat nav. So, yeah, I mean, logically, it would go that way. But that's, you know, it becomes self-sustaining. The car's always online. You can see your car, and then it becomes, you know, you've got a car show, which is odd. And, you know, Seinfeld's been doing that now with comedians in cars getting coffee. And, you know, videos of people in cars is just a common thing.
Well, that was the next line I was going to talk about, because clearly the one aspect that hasn't been featured in terms of comedians in cars is your good self. I mean, in the academic world, are we just as guilty as this as other sort of folk, in terms of whether we're millennials or indeed Generation X from that point of view, that we actually, you know, we got a new car, we'll suddenly sort of put it all on social media? Or would you say, no, that's frightfully rude?
This isn't new behaviour, really. It's just now that it's online, we can see it a lot more, and you have the option of sharing it. People have always been doing things to gain prestige. You know, people have, you know, keep up with the Joneses is a very old phenomenon, or like buying a car, a high-end sports car, was always a way to impress your neighbours, impress your friends. There's always that influence. It's now it's far more, you know, invasive. It's far more like open and out there now. So I guess it's a bit more honest approach, but no, this isn't a new. This isn't something specific to millennials. It's just the online aspect, which is a bit intriguing. So, yeah, this is familiar behaviour, just ramped up by the internet, as is always the case, I guess.
Well, clearly, what we need to have as well is the notion of virtual drivers for those virtual cars, and then you can actually talk about the chauffeurs as well from that point of view. Dean, where can people go to find out further information about this research from Admiral and more?
Admiral.com/generationcar is the place to go if you want to see all this data yourself. It's quite a lot there. It's quite intriguing.
And I clearly have to ask you the question, Dean. Mm. Did you actually drive to the studio this morning yourself, or were you chauffeured, or did you take public transport?
I took public transport last night and stayed in a hotel.
So well, there we are. It's clear, balanced from that body. And will people be able to find that on social media?
No, I didn't take any photos because I'm not the most photogenic subject, so I thought I'm going to not inflict that on people.
Dean, I think we salute you for that perspective. Many thanks indeed. Take care and have a splendid day.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all well and good, Dr. Dean Burnett, but ultimately Ian Lennox is the voice that we need to hear about when it comes to... Ian, have you ever been tempted to actually promote your ego and standing amongst your peers by saying, look at that flash automobile I've just got?
No, people would laugh at me if I did that. They know me too well. look at that flash number 33 bus.
Yeah, well, you know, that's social media. I mean, I do know you love sharing videos of cats with only two back legs and little cats who look like German dictators, and it's heartrending. But, you know, that's all past the whole thing. The key and important side of thing is that... You've got a point. Hey, congratulations, Cardiff City. You got a point. Hey, so results there, I think, in many ways.
Oh, it was a bad game, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, do you feel Kennedy justice was served in essence? Do you feel, or do you think actually, if only he'd actually sort of popped that ball in the back of the net, it would have been three magical points for us?
Well, I can think of no one less likely to score than he did after that. The performance. I mean, he had a dreadful afternoon. In fact, I think if he had been sent off, I might have won.
Apparently he had a nightmare, according to various reports.
After the game, number four?
The crude, the bad, and the ugly. A whole range of things happening. But at least, you know, good news, Ian, no retrospective ban for the man. So that's all.
No, I didn't go into the reasons for that. Had the referee seen the incident, therefore? He wore the foul, didn't he? So he had seen the incident. So
he's avoided a retrospective three-game ban for kicking out at the whole system.
That was amazing, wasn't it?
Yep, well, Neil Warnock, manager, of course, of Cardiff, said the challenge should have resulted in a straight red card, which obviously coming from Neil Warnock.
Well, one of his own players should have been sent off as well, of course.
Who is clearly a referee, yes, who knows what's happening. So are you all set for the next upcoming games where I believe you're at home to that fine bunch of lads from Stamford Bridge, otherwise known as, of course, last season's, it's a couple of seasons ago, champions. That would be Chelsea, exactly.
Yes. Well, we're at home, so won last season against them.
Exactly, and I'm sure that you will take Maurizio. No, is it Maurizio Sarri? Anyway, they get so many managers these days. And then, of course, you're down in the East Midlands next Wednesday, so just ahead of the connection for next week, the 30th of August. On the 29th of August, your lads will be performing against Nottingham Forest.
Oh, in the Cup, yes.
The Carabao Cup. The English Football League Cup, etc. And then, all being well, you'll be able to actually see how it should be done when you visit the Etihad on the following Saturday. So that's good.
That's a daunting prospect.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if you watch the Amazon Prime video on City, and I've watched all eight episodes, all packed together, I think you'll find yourself a much brighter and wonderful individual, if that such a thing was possible.
I have been
watching
it, actually. I've seen the first two episodes on Netflix, aren't they?
I think Guardiola comes across as a very articulate and very sage and sensible person manager.
I tell you what I did watch last night was the famed documentary on Bobby Robson.
Right.
Guardiola is among some of the major figures.
Yes.
He played for Robson, apparently, Barcelona.
Exactly. You see, this is the reason why I just do not know why you will continue to support Mike Ashley's boys when you've got another side that would be much more beneficial from your overall routine. Then again, we do appreciate the joys that Mike Ashley brings to the tune, because I know he's much loved.
You do love putting this stuff in.
Even though you might not say it at the time. Well, you know, let's face it, in terms of class, who would you rather have? Would you like to have Sheikh Mansour or indeed Chairman Mubarak, or would you like to have Mike Ashley? It's a tough call, you know.
In terms of money, isn't it, really?
Is it? Well, I
don't know. That's what you're willing to invest.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, life continues. So what will the rest of the day be having in store for yourself, Ian Lennox, on what is apparently going to be a fairly breezy day with general coolness and a high in Lincoln, at least, of 20 degrees centigrade?
Right, well, I've got some lodgers arriving shortly, so I'm going to have to
clean house up a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now,
I've got some shopping to do. I've got a bit of writing I'm trying to do. Are these
lodgers theatrical souls?
Yeah, oh yes, always. Yeah.
Always, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know the offer is always there. If any theatrical soul would like to benefit not only from actually staying in Lennox Towers, but also have the opportunity of doing some radio material as well, we're always there.
Ah, right. Pattern of living is they work nights and they're very rarely up before 12 o'clock.
Well, Ian, you see, we do a show on Wednesday evenings between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. So there's always a slot there, you see. And there
one of the ladies said she was a wiggy, and that's, I mean, she does wigs for the shows. So I don't know.
Well, it may well mean that, who knows? I mean, hair pieces, toupees, they're not what they used to be, but there we are. That's whole and I personally would feel, no, I'm not going to go down that line, unless, of course, you pay significant sums of funding.
Oh, of course, yes, I forget about that. Yeah.
Whereabouts in your house, Ian, does the television sit? Because this is something we'll be talking about in the next part of the programme, which is in terms of interior designer Mel Massey. Apparently, the television still remains the focal point of many British folks' lounge. 44% of British people surveyed by Samsung view the television as the focal point of their lounge, and indeed there's still a reluctance to actually mount your TV on the wall.
Yeah, my because of my own particular circumstances, I've got televisions in all the bedrooms because I have to for the lodgers.
Right.
I have got a very large television in my lounge. Mm. 75-inch television.
Well, you see, just because you worked for Tyne Tees Television doesn't mean you have to brag. But there we are. 67% of people apparently still use a stand for their television. 67% still use a stand for their television.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Where is
I've got a wall mount in the kitchen.
Is it a no-gap wall mount?
It's the one that can move around and wiggle about.
Oh, well, there we are. We'll talk about that. Anyway, Mel Massey, who is actually a lead designer on the BBC television programme DIY SOS. He'll be commenting on why the contemporary styles in people's lounges are proving to be so popular. Plus, of course, it's GCSE day. Last week was those A-level results day. It looks as though the usual media furore is starting over confusion vis-a-vis GCSE results and so on and so forth. And when all's said and done, just be happy, be positive, and make sure you've done your best. That's the important thing, really. And so, sort of words of wisdom for that.
Do you remember your GCSEs?
Yeah, I do, actually.
The day of the results.
Except they weren't GCSEs, they were GCEs.
Yes, exactly.
They were O-levels. They were O-levels, etc.
That's
A-levels. Ian, I suspect you might have actually been school certificate. Perhaps not.
Ah, right.
Well, there we are.
The thing I remember of those sort of things is my son, who were on holiday in Menorca, I think it was, when his results came out.
Yeah.
And he'd found his results by ringing
the school,
I think.
Yes,
And he's doing quite well.
Well, of course.
And then he rang.
He's a Lennox. What else do you expect?
And then he rang his friend, and he discovered his friend had done very badly.
Ah.
And his friend then asked, "How do you do?" And Scarlett, such a considerate kid, he said, "I don't know. I haven't got them yet." Because he didn't want to seem as though he's gloating over his friend.
Isn't that the reason that's often given in terms of why Chris Waddle skied the penalty in Turin in 1990? It's because he didn't want Stuart Pearce to look bad.
I've never heard that before.
That was shared with me literally the day after by a school technician that I was working with at the time, and he said it's because Stuart Pearce was so liked by Chris Waddle, he felt he had to miss it because otherwise Stuart Pearce would have felt bad. There we are. Anyway, that's a bit of a strategy.
Is there any evidence for that?
As with all sorts of things within the Bobby Robson era, who knows what the manifesting the world will actually sort of
come. Two things I remember. It's the 1990 World Cup we're talking about.
Yes.
I was filming in France in the summer of 89, and one of the features, I didn't do it, but I was there, was an interview with Chris Waddle, who just joined Marseille, and I spent the day with him. And I don't know if you remember, but the press were absolutely hacking Robson to bits, so calling him a turnip head or something, and stuff like that.
For God's sake, go, was the line that was used.
Yes, it was absolutely terrible. Anyway, but I had it then. I went out for an evening meal with Chris, and he told me he thought England could win the cup. And I said, really? He said, yes. He said, we've got a very good side. He's a good, very good player. And he was proved to be right. They could have won it. They came within inches of winning it because they've beaten Germany. They hit the post twice, I think.
As close as Gareth Southgate's team almost came this summer as well.
Yeah. I think...
there's
no doubt if we'd beaten Germany, we would have won, I think.
If memory serves, Waddle started his life as a sausage manufacturer in Peelaw, but there we are. Or at least a sausage tester.
I Peelaw.
Was it not Peelaw?
It's not that area.
Ian, to the average Lincoln listener...
He worked in a sausage factory, I know.
Names like Peelaw, names like Middlesbrough, lost.
He nearly joined Sunderland. One of my friends who's dead now is a chap called Lenny Heppel, who's a balance expert. A brilliant balance expert. He worked with Malcolm Allison for years. And he was called in by Sunderland. And they said, I want to look at this lad and see if he can improve his running style. If he can, we'll sign him. And he looked at Chris Waddle running. He said, I can't improve it. He said, it's perfect, and walked off. And Sunderland didn't sign him because of that.
And that's the message we take with us as we begin to head to the news from the Sky News Centre. And then after that, we have Head of Engineering at the Institute of Engineering and Technology, that's IET, David Lakin, who's actually calling for a more balanced curriculum with more STEM subjects, STEM university courses, and a whole heap of other goodies as well. Ian, how are Ollie and Obo?
Ollie has had his breakfast and has gone out on the town.
Mm-hmm.
And hasn't come back from his night out revelry, I think.
And Ian, please, it's all right. You can actually say he's gone out for a night on the tune, because it's all right. On the town. On the tune.
It's
very true. So I take it you've had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
Oh, yes, indeed, yes.
Back with us again next week?
I hope so.
Excellent. Fast forward to 18, we are more than lovers. Yeah, we are.